evening. Welcome to a Broken Bread Bible study, study number 26. This is a little bit different because the communications all broke down when we were trying to do the live radio broadcast. So I'm trying to do one in my study now on my own and get it to Mike as soon as I can. So we'll see how we do. Welcome, anyway, to Broken Bread Bible Studies, a joint production of BibleBase.com with me, Ron Bailey, and with Mike Coles with newliferadio.co.uk in Exeter. My title for tonight, second time I've said this, is What It Says on the Tin. Now, I'm aware that that may well be an illustration that's not familiar to people on the other side of the Atlantic. It was from an advertising campaign for a preservative paint for fences and garden sheds. Ron Seal, it was called. It had nothing at all to do with me, even though they pinched the first three letters of my name. Ron Seal, it does what it says on the tin. And on the tin, it said that it sealed and preserved such things. On the tin, it said that it sealed and preserved fences and sheds. It passed into British usage. It means it's an accurate indication of the contents. It does what it says on the tin. As a boy, I wanted a penknife. Another nationwide manufacturer, this time of tinned soups and vegetables, ran another advertising campaign. Collect the labels off six of their tins or cans, send it with a postal order for 2 and 6 pence, that's an eighth of a pound, and they would send you a small stainless steel penknife. Small boys aren't very good at waiting. I slipped into the pantry and used a pair of scissors to remove labels from six tins. I got my penknife, but my mother got a problem. What did the shiny tins contain? How could she prepare her meals? Puzzle enough, but imagine what would happen if someone came along and put new labels on the tins according to their fancy, or in our case, according to their theological convictions. Now the problem become even more difficult. We've got the wrong labels on the wrong tins, and sometimes we've got labels that don't mean anything in a biblical sense. We're back to this question of the problem of translations. It has to do with semantic range. What does a semantic range mean? Well, it's a bundle of words, a bundle of meanings. In a Greek language, for example, we'll take the word flesh, it's sarx, probably where we get the word sarcasm from. So be careful with your sarcastic sense of humour. It's sarx, and even in Paul's writing in a single letter, in Galatians, for example, you'll find he uses it in at least three different ways. If we want to convey the truth, we either try and be consistent with one word translating one Greek word, but it won't do justice to the Greek word, or we add three completely different words and people lose the connection between the same word being used. What is a Bible translator to do? Let me show you where the problem is. There are 19 references to flesh in Paul's letter to the Galatians. And the first few of them, this is the first five or six of them, are innocuous. I mean by that they're neutral. They have no real sense of evil. For example, Paul writes that Christ revealed himself to Paul so that he might reveal his Son in me, that I might preach him among the Gentiles. And then he says, I did not immediately confer with flesh and blood. That simply means, in a human way, naturally speaking, he didn't confer with human beings over this thing. How about this one? This is the same usage of that word to mean something which really is naturally speaking. This is Galatians chapter 2 and verse 20. I have been crucified with Christ. It's no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And the life which I now live in the flesh. Now, doesn't Paul later on say we're not supposed to be living our lives in the flesh? The life which I now live in the flesh, I live by the faith of the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me. You see, what the word really means in this kind of situation is humanly speaking, or naturally speaking. Some are less obvious. For example, there's a little group of them where it really just simply means physically speaking. When Paul first visited the Galatians, he refers to that visit in this letter to the Galatians and says that it was through infirmity of the flesh that I preached the gospel unto you at the first. Now, it's presumed, and there's good evidence for it, that Paul had some kind of eye condition. Some people think it might have been some effects of a malarial condition. And he needed a rest, he needed a break, he needed to recover, and that's why he was in this with this particular group of people. But when he says the infirmity of the flesh is vulnerable, clearly, the body is vulnerable, but there's no real evil sense in that. He says, my trial which was in my flesh, you did not despise or reject, but you received me as an angel of God, even as Christ Jesus. So there's that other sense of it. And then there's another one where the word flesh, the idea of flesh, definitely has a kind of an ominous ring to it. For you, brethren, he says in chapter 5, verse 13, have been called to liberty. Only do not use liberty as an opportunity for the flesh, but through love serve one another. That's Galatians 5, verse 13. This is Galatians 5, 16 and 17. I say, then, walk in the Spirit, and you shall not fulfill the lust of the flesh. For the flesh lusts against the Spirit, and the Spirit against the flesh. And these are contrary to one another, so that you do not do the things that you wish. And later on, he has a great list of sins, and he calls them the works of the flesh. Then later on, he says, though, this is chapter 5, verse 24, those who are Christ's have crucified the flesh with its passions and desires, and so on. So that literally means, well, we better try and find out what it does mean and see if we can put it together. Are you familiar with Vine's Expository Dictionary of New Testament Words? It is a great tool for Bible study, whether you're using it as a physical book or whether you're accessing it from somewhere like the Blue Letter Bible. There are lots of modern versions of Expository Dictionary of the New Testament Words, and they often advertise themselves as a 21st century replacement for Vine's or a modernized or an updated Vine's. In my humble opinion, Vine's is still the best. But several times in, well, look at Vine. Vine has 13 different moods, tones, ways in which the word flesh is expressed. You look at that at your leisure. And the International Standard Bible does pretty much the same. We've often said, haven't we, do you remember our little mantra? Contrast, contrast, contrast. Well, these words, like sock, have what scholars call a semantic range. That means they have not just a single meaning, they can often have a complex meaning, and it can be a very wide range of meanings. A semantic range. Semantic has to do with language. We might say Greek words, and Hebrew words for that matter, and English words often have a bundle of meanings. If I might say, well, he's running for election, I've got something in my eye and it's making it run. I might say that road runs up over the mountaintop. Now, all that's part of the bundle of the way that we in English use the word run. And the same thing happens in all languages. So it's very difficult sometimes to get an exact equivalent in one language to a word in another language. So what do? Well, really, words can only be understood by their usage. not the dictionary definition, because words change. It's cool, say the younger generation. But they don't put a warmer coat on. They mean they're having a good time. You see, so if I used a dictionary from the beginning of the 20th century and looked up the word cool, I'll have no idea what my young neighbour is saying to me when he says his bike is cool. Words change their meaning. Bible words don't, of course, but they do have a context. So we need to look at the context, and we'll have to do that. Now, this has already taken quite a time, so I'm going to jump to the conclusion of this section, and then we'll kind of come back to it, just to keep this as a fairly short one tonight, in as much as we've had some technical difficulties, I think that's the phrase. I'm going to jump to the conclusion. This is the passage from Galatians 5, verse 13 to 17. For you, brethren, have been called to liberty. Only do not use your liberty as an opportunity for the flesh, but through love serve one another. I want you to notice the contrast of something which is an opportunity to the flesh or love serving one another. For all the law is fulfilled in one word, even in this, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. But if you bite and devour one another, beware, lest you be consumed by one another. I say then, walk in the Spirit, and you shall not fulfill the lust of the flesh. For the flesh lusts against the Spirit, and the Spirit against the flesh. And these are contrary to one another, so that you do not do the things that you wish. That's Galatians 5:17 in the New King James Version. So let's just have a look at this and see if we can see the kind of area we're in. He says here, for example, you, brethren, have been called to liberty. Do not use liberty as an opportunity for the flesh. There's that word, the beachhead. So this liberty that we have to not subscribe to commit ourselves to the written letter of the Sinaitic covenant opens us to a danger. It opens us to the danger that we may use our liberty as a beachhead for the flesh. This becomes what's sometimes known as antinomianism, where people abolish all laws and say, no, I just do exactly what I'm self. If it suits you, please it. If you do it, it's fine. Just do what you want to do. Paul says there's a danger here that in our calling to liberty, we don't use that liberty. We could use it, but if we have to be careful that we don't use it, it's an opportunity to the flesh, because the flesh wants to build a bridgehead, and your opportunity may well be your liberty. So what's the goal in all this? Well, we've already touched on it. Through love, serve one another. For all the love is fulfilled in one word, even in this you shall love your neighbour as yourself. If you have your Bible, have a look at that terrible list of sins of the flesh, and you will see that if you loved your neighbour as yourself, you would eliminate your danger to every one of that list. So you don't need a list of things which says don't do this, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. All you need is this positive command which says through love, serve one another. I'm so glad love and serve come next to one another. It's the service of love. It's your servants for Jesus' sake, as Paul said when he wrote to the Corinthians. If our first goal is to love our neighbours ourselves in serving them for Jesus' sake, we will not fulfil the desires of the flesh. These things that we should read at, these works of the flesh, it speaks of the desires and it speaks of the works of the flesh. I want to make a distinction between those two that we'll come to next time we're together. But that's the goal, that we serve one another. For all the law is fulfilled in one word, even in this, you shall love your neighbour as yourself. And if we don't, there are deadly consequences. This follows on from verse 14 into verse 15. He says, but if you bite and devour one another, beware, lest you be consumed by one another. I can remember at school we had an English teacher who loved to use highfalutin ways of expressing things. And one thing that annoyed him intensely was boys who chewed their nails while they were trying to understand what he was telling us. And he would get very angry at what he called auto-cannibalism. It's interesting. Carne, the word flesh in Latin, comes really from an idea of stripping the flesh of something with your teeth. If you bite and devour one another, beware, lest you be consumed by one another. If, instead of using your liberty to serve one another in love, you become in opposition to your neighbor, to your brother, your sister. If you bite and devour, if instead of laying down your life for them, you're willing to take their life as long as you survive, beware, lest you be consumed by one another. That can cause a terrible spiral, a terrible circle of violence, spiritual violence, in a family, in a church, amongst the people of God. That's sobering, isn't it? Let's change the mood a little bit. Because there's a guarantee of victory. In this conflict that Paul is going to describe, there is a guarantee of victory. And here it is, chapter 5 and verse 16. I say then, walk in the Spirit, and you shall not fulfill the lusts of the flesh. Really? All of them? Well, come back to what this word lust means in a minute. Because if you look at verse 17, it says this, for the flesh lusts against the Spirit. That word lust doesn't necessarily mean something which is evil or salacious in any way. When Jesus said, with desire, I have desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer, he used this exact word. It means a strong desire. So let's put that in its place. For the flesh's strong desires are against the Spirit. And the Spirit, we'll put it in bracket, his strong desires are against the flesh. You've got a collision of strong desires here. And he says quite clearly, they're contrary to the one, to the other. So that, what, there may be a kind of an interminable quarrel, with the black dog sometimes beating the white dog and the white dog sometimes beating the black dog, with this balance, this counteraction of forces, this two natures scrapping it out one by one. Is that what he says? No, let's see what he says. For the flesh lusts against the Spirit, and the Spirit against the flesh. For these are contrary the one to the other, so that ye may not do the things that ye would. Now, can you see the sense in that? It's the dynamic of victory. That ye may not do the things that ye would. This is John Wesley. That being thus strengthened by the Spirit, you may not fulfill the desire of the flesh, as otherwise you would do. So, is your glass half empty or half full? Do you say it's inevitable we shall fall and slip and sin and whatever word you want to put it, inevitable? Or do you see that the Spirit has strong desires, and if we walk in the Spirit, his desires will be fulfilled, and not the desires of the flesh? Every time. That being thus strengthened by the Spirit, ye may not fulfill the desire of the flesh, as otherwise ye would do. That's John Wesley in his commentary on the New Testament. So there's a guarantee of victory. There's a promise that as we walk in the Spirit, you will not fulfill the lusts of the flesh. We've been called to liberty. We've got a goal. And our goal is not to satisfy our own strong desires. We'll talk about the origins of those next time. Not to satisfy our own desires for our own sensual gratification, whatever that might be. But to determine that through love, we will serve one another. You see, every one of this list that we're going to come to is actually a sin against somebody else. It's the consequence of putting yourself first and somebody else second. It's the consequence of using people as though they are things to achieve your objectives, rather than understanding they are people that God has brought into your life for you to serve for love's sake. I think we'll stop there for tonight. Brothers and sisters, I apologize for the quirks of my computer. I'm not quite sure what's happening to it at the moment, or quite how we sort it out. And I'm sorry if this has spoiled what you're expecting to hear on Thursday night, but God willing, we'll have this up as a podcast tomorrow, and I'll get it to Mike as well, so that even though it didn't happen, you'll have a repeat of it in his New Life Radio place where he puts all his goodies for you to have. Sorry again, but thank you for bearing with us, and we trust to see you next week when normal service will be resumed. God bless you.